Welcome to the Accord Report and Weekly Review. We are so glad to be with you and to be a part of our podcast here on January 22. It's Monday, Paul Harrell and myself, Dominic Aquila, are here to go over the top 10 articles that appear last week from last week's articles in the Aquila Report. And as I like to remind everyone, that these top 10 articles come from the articles that we already post that people read, and then we just count up the clicks on the articles, and there you have your top 10. So at that point, we just are real glad that we can sort of present them to you, give our opinions and feelings, and just give you a heads up on what is coming. So tomorrow on Tuesday, the Aquila Report weekly newsletter comes out with the top 10. They're hyperlinked and ready to be clicked on, and then you can read them at your own leisure. So, Paul, it's good to be back. We missed a few weeks here because of cold and holidays weather and the like, and yeah. It's good. So I know you got some snow up your way. You surviving?
Yeah, we did. I mean, it just kind of shuts southern towns down for as long as the snow stays. and it's really just been the temperature. The snow was, manageable, but then the temperature just been like 2 degrees, 9 degrees. It's just been rough, but, we're surviving up here. So
that's great. Well, just as we've done in the past, you read the top 10, from 10 to 6, I'll read from 5 to 1, and then we'll begin our overview and highlighting of these articles.
Sounds good. So number 10 last week, we've got Daniel Frost and Robert P. George writing Destroying Marriage in Order to Save It. Number 9, The Ruling Elder and the Ministry of Prayer. This by Steve Dowling. Number 8 from last week, Sean McGinty, Review Omphalos, An Attempt to Untie the Geological Knot. Interesting piece there. Number 7, Bill Muhlenberg, How Not to Be a Grumpy Old Man or Woman. And number 6, Lessons from the Lutheran Tradition for 2024, written by Carl R. Truman.
Okay, number 5 then is Philip Ryan writes an article, Where Are the Peaceable Presbyters? That might go along with the one that number 7 there about not being grumpy old man or woman. Okay, number 4 is Damned Be the Ties That Bind. This is by Timon Klein. Number 3 is a committee report on church music by Barry Waugh. Number 2, The Resistance Will Be Organized, and that's by Aaron M. Wren. And then number 1, It Doesn't Work, Reformed Presbyterian Church in America, and this is by Aaron Vriesman. It Doesn't Work, Reformed Church in America. That's the RCA. It's a Dutch background church that has gone through quite an overview and metamorphosis in its handling of LGBTQ and other theological issues over the probably last 60 years. And so in this article, Aaron Vriesman, who himself is a minister in the Christian Reformed Church that came out of the Reformed Church of America, because it's one of the Reformed Church of America has one of the longest histories in the United States, having come from Holland and settling and opening their first church in the 1620s in Manhattan, and all the stories about Manhattan being bought for $24 of trinkets or something like that, whether it's probably true or not, were associated with the Dutch. So here's this church that has a long history, and in our country, and there was a division between that group and the new immigrants that were coming about the year 1857 to form the Christian Reformed Church. So they're brother-sister or sister-sister churches. And so in this article, and just another thing, Aaron Vriesman is also a director with the Abide Project, which is ministry within, an independent ministry within the Christian Reformed Church. But he's writing this history on the Reformed Church in America and giving an overview. And he starts out with quite a lengthy view on the history of how they got here and how the two churches then divided. And then he takes up and does, a very long one. It's not a short article, but a very interesting one that entered the topic of homosexuality. He says the first time the RCA made any statements on LGBT matters was in June 12 through 16 of 1978, a General Synod meeting at Columbia University. There, the delegates approved a paper entitled Homosexuality, a Biblical and Theological Appraisal. And you can find those in the minutes of that year's General Synod. And for those who aren't familiar with the Continental Reform, tend to use the word synod, as opposed to those with Scottish, British background churches use the word General Assembly. The paper presented a clear biblical rejection of homosexual acts, but also affirmed the dignity of homosexual persons. So it gives some of the paper's statements that include things like Paul's rejection of homosexual activities beyond question. When Paul rejects homosexual acts on the grounds that they are against nature, he expresses and reaffirms the clear sense of Scripture that human sexuality was created for heterosexual expression and so forth. Heterosexuality also is not only normal, it is normative. Homosexual acts are contrary to the will of God. While we cannot affirm that homosexual behavior are the same, we can affirm it at the same time we're convinced that its denial of the human and civil rights of homosexual is inconsistent with biblical witness and so forth. So the number of really affirmative things about the sin of homosexuality and how the church looked at it. And then we begins a progress of showing how little by little by little, okay, Paul, you can look at the timer and say that the slippery slope began to manifest itself. This position would be affirmed the next year in 79, again in 1990 and 94. And but after those periods of time, Vriesman says in this article, in 1997, the General Synod did not discuss homosexuality, but did enter a formula of agreement with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, ELCA, which is at that time a fairly new Lutheran group that had broken off mainly from the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. They also entered it with the Presbyterian Church USA and United Church of Christ. And in 2004, the General Synod affirmed that marriage is properly defined as a union, one man, one woman, to the exclusion of others. And the commission of the church order was asked to consider an amendment to the Book of Order that added the affirmation of the RCA's church order. Well, in 2005, the commission reported it had considered the amendments to the Book of Order, but did not feel it was appropriate and gave six reasons why not. So what more began to happen, though, is that the president of one of their seminaries was dismissed for presiding at his daughter's lesbian wedding. So that was in 2005. And the Church of Jesus Christ needs to be an inclusive as the arms of our Lord himself, the president said. In 2009, the General Synod voted to affirm the value of continued dialogue, discernment on the topic of homosexuality. And so they did. And then by 2011, the New Brunswick Classis, that's Presbytery, ordained practicing homosexual Ursula Cargill as minister. Five applicants would challenge the action, but the Regional Synod of the Mid-Atlantics, which is a presbytery, would uphold her ordination the following May. And so the slippery slope continued. So by 2013, the professor of Western Theological Seminary, James Brownson, wrote a book called The Bible, Gender, Sexuality, Reframing the Church's Debate on Same-Sex Relationships. And it says, in his lengthy arguments and extensively engaged scripture, former RCA General Secretary Wesley Gransberg Michelson writes in the foreword, James Brownson's grounds his approach in foundational biblical understanding of gender and sexuality. He takes the Bible seriously, engaging in it faithfully and deeply as he encourages the reader to do the same. And he says the church needs this book. So in 2013 General Synod, there was a liberal resurgence, and they voted 129-91 to remove the 2012 statement promoting homosexuality to be a disciplinable action or offense. So the work goes on and on until it gets down to the final time that where the Synod finally adopts what we would call side A position. And so it's a very detailed thing just to show that it wasn't something that happened. It was creep, mission creep, if you would, that would take place. And so in the rest of this article, which continues, like I said, quite lengthily, Aaron Vriesman shows where things are. So that now, out of that, in the last 10 years, we affirm the Orthodox view again. It still hasn't changed. He says that there's been a division in the church between a group that about 2021, there was Alliance of Reformed Churches, ARC, that was formed out of the Reformed Church in America. And since that time, more and more churches have left the RCA, the Reformed Church of America, to go into the ARC, the Alliance of Reformed Churches. Anyway, it's a long thing. Spent that time in it because I wanted to honor that, but just to show it starts very, very slowly and increases over time. And Paul, as I read this, I couldn't help but think that you and I, as we come here and doing these cooler report and weekly review, constantly mentioned the fact that we went through some of those cycles in the Presbyterian Church in America and through General Assemblies and on battling it in the local level as well, presbytery level. And we kept saying, you know, it's always a little tug, a little push. You know, it was very simple here, very simple there. And eventually we would wind up where we didn't want to be. And fortunately, the PCA took another tack and has dealt with it differently than this.
Yep.
History.
It's interesting that it's still, you know, still the number one article. It just kind of, like you said, reinforces everything that we said during that controversy. And again, you know, you just look to these other denominations, and that is our future if we give an inch, mm-hmm. really. Right. So it should really just encourage us, and also, again, you know, just be thankful that that we didn't, you know, that it didn't go off the rails. Mm-hmm. So I'm thankful to the men in the PCA for sure, and I still think there's work to be done, but so far so good, you know.
Very good. So that's number one. Number two, maybe in a different way, it deals with a broader picture of evangelicalism in America. Brought more broadly than just the one denomination. And this is by Aaron Rand, "The Resistance Will Be Organized. Anti-Trump Evangelicals Are Very Organized and Well-Funded." This is the beginning of Aaron Rand doing a review of Tim Alberta's book, "The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism." And he says that he's getting ready to, when he wrote this article, that he was doing a review for the Claremont Review of Books, which of course will be much, much longer. And so he just reflects on some of the things that are here. And it was basically the tensions in the middle, in the 2010 through 20, in that range, where some of these battles on homosexuality, about the place of gender dysphoria, the woke or the lack of woke minister thing, anti-racism, you know, you have that, those things were taking place around this time, that some things began to take place. It says anti-Trump evangelicals started getting organized. And this is the theme, basically, of this article, is that this book by Tim Alberta gives deep details about the organization that most of us suspected, but we really couldn't point to. And this says the anti-Trump evangelicals started getting organized at least as far back as 2015. In the fall of 2015, Russell Moore met with the Outliers, a group of friends and fellow high-profile believers. Tim Keller, the founding pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, Pete Weiner, the former head of strategic initiatives in the George W. Bush White House, Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, and David Brooks, the New York Times columnist. And they discussed the GOP primary and attraction of Trump and their differing views on how things would play out when it came to evangelical support for him. Of course, when Trump came in at that time, Paul, you'll remember he still, you know, it just sort of happened. So there was no sense of or pulse of what, you know, where people in the country would break out, much less different segments of the population. So a few things are interesting here. He says, first, this group of people gave themselves a name, the Outliers. This is the group that Russell Moore headed up. And so they are probably gathering or talking even before this meeting to have reached a point of giving their group a name. Note that Russell is portrayed as a guest of this group, at least initially. Second, in the fall of 2015, at a time where few people believed Trump would win the GOP nomination, much less the presidency, he says, Aaron speaking for himself, I did a podcast with my father on my old feed, which is no longer online, at the end of October 15, saying that based on my interactions with some folks back home, Trump was a serious candidate. And this actually got some attention from people. So unusual was it that at that time, the fact that this group was in existence so early makes me wonder when it formed and if they actually predated Trump and were really alienated from the mainstream of evangelicalism. So again, just like the first article, this one has quite a bit of history of momentum and a lot of meeting people. There's one person who stood out was the fact that they, as they were getting organized, a man named Curtis Chang from the West Coast. Consulting is a noble profession, he is, by must say myself, but I suspect very few of the evangelicals who consumed Chang's materials, because he was also a person who provided structural guidance to people who were interested in fundraising, because he involved in politics and other things. And so he was a professional in that regard. So consulting, noble profession, but I suspect very few of the evangelicals who consulted Chang's materials were where he was producing them as a consultant for the government and this little task he was involved in. I did not know until I read this book. By the way, I got vaccinated, he said, and boosted for COVID. One of the things that Chang was doing was really promoting that COVID-19 shots and boosting was important. But anyway, after the party was Chang's idea, that is, that Outliers now had another little name called After Party. One afternoon while hiking the Gray Wild Whale Cove Trail along the spectacular San Mateo coast, Chang laid it out for French. There needed to be an organized, visible, well-funded effort to counter the work done by likes of Charlie Kirk, Eric Metaxas, Ralph Reed, and Dave Barton, and so many others in the MAGA right. Chang didn't envision some puritanical campaign to banish politics from church altogether. What he hoped for was to articulate as an alternative to the maniac enemy at the gates mindset that was infecting American evangelicalism. This would be the best accomplished by a systematic curriculum, something that we could study by individuals in small groups, something focused on the who or the what of politics, but on the question, not on that, but on the question of how Christians are called to engage. And talks about he walked into a meeting of unbelievers, people who fund political events, and walking in the initial meeting with secular funds, Chang halfway wondered if he had was losing his mind. And there were some of the same people who couldn't fathom vaccine hesitancy among evangelicals, who had zero understanding of the church's conflicts regarding politics, policy, and culture. And now they were going to bankroll his Christian curriculum enterprise. Yes, that's what they all said. Yes. In retrospect, Chang told me it couldn't have been, it was such a surprise. And so out of that came the funding for a lot of what took place then during that first Trump go around, as the evangelicals then were not knowing it. Now we know it from this history, targeted to with reference to their not being committed to Trump as many seem to be. And I think, Paul, if you memory serves, it was probably like 80%. Of those who had self-identified, I guess, as evangelicals, claimed to have voted for Trump. So Rand is just saying Tim Alberta's book has opened up another factoid, and it's filled with good biography and bibliography. And it's interesting that all this was happening and we were not aware of it.
Nope, we weren't. But we now know. I mean, these people have just, I feel like continue to expose themselves. And this is a really good article. When he says, I'll say Chang himself is on the political left. Russell Moore is a lifetime Democrat. David French is certainly deeply estranged from conservative evangelicalism. Their project is conceived as a direct competitor to MAGA mobilization. Of course, secular leftists funders are going to pay for it. You know, these strongest voices that are wanting those of us on the right to disengage from politics, it seems like those people saying that are themselves really, truly engaging in politics. Mm-hmm. And that's what's obvious to me. The other day, and I think this goes perfectly with this, because you want to know what happened, with COVID. And, I know Francis Collins was mentioned at the top of this. I think some of the stuff that we now know about the censorship, they tried to say in this article, it's funny, they cite a black pastor trying to save Russell Moore's job when the SBC was considering getting rid of them. And he cites that the relationship he made with this group as being the one that saved his job because the SBC didn't want bad press. And the black pastor, was quoted to the Washington Post when they wrote a story about the potential firing of Russell Moore and says, well, we would hate this. This would be bad for send a bad signal. It would have a chilling effect on, African-Americans and their affiliation with the Southern Baptist Convention. I think a chilling effect. A chilling effect? Isn't that interesting? Back in the day, that's the term they were using. And yet, during COVID, we saw more censorship than we've ever seen in modern American life. The level of censorship about getting information out, competing narratives, I mean, it was unbelievable. I recently saw a clip, Dominic, from Rick Warren, who was back in 2008. Now, Rick Warren used to be, I believe he gave the prayer, one of the prayers at Obama's inauguration. I mean, he was the guy that was acceptable. The media presented Rick Warren as, here's an evangelical that, we can put legitimacy to and give some credence to. In 2008, he went to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. Now, the World Economic Forum are, in my opinion, where real life James Bond villains go to plot a, Tower of Babel 2.0 situation. And he said, I saw the clip in 2008, he was encouraging, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, you've got the politicians and government trying to, and big business trying to solve the world's problems. But what they're not utilizing is the local minister, the local pastor that has trust, that has, garnered trust with his congregation. And we need the, and so he was there essentially as an emissary trying to get the World Economic Forum to use evangelical figures or people that we respect to basically disseminate globalist propaganda to our congregations. And I think this group, this little secret cabal, consisting of David French and others, is proof that that's exactly what happened. And so, you want to talk about coordination. Yeah, we didn't know this level of coordination. We didn't know it was going on in 2008. And yet here it is. And it's just, you know, it's food for thought. So anyway,
it is. And it's a helpful thing. So the Tim Alberta's book was just recently published. So Rand will be doing a significant review of it in the soon, if it hasn't already been published. And that'll really be something for us to look at and discuss in terms of looking back on time. So not only did you have Reisman giving the what happened with the RCA church in that over from 1978 all the way to 2020 and its transformation internally, but you have then the work on the outside, people who are supposedly inside evangelicalism working outside with other outside forces against what they perceive may be coming because of Trump. So the politics is involved, but for our purposes, it's the what church was doing as evangelical. So interesting article that Ren brings up. Okay, number three takes us in a different direction. This is a committee report on church music. Now that article, that title doesn't, you know, exactly rouse our cockles. But the reason I think it's number three, Paul, it written by Barry Waugh, it's a historic piece. And Barry has become a writer. We've been running more of his articles on different aspects of American Presbyterianism and its influence and things that a lot of us just aren't aware of because he's taking us in different directions. Like this committee that's talking about during the 19th century, you know, Presbyterianism heavily influenced by the Scottish church and Calvin, basically in terms of worship, their music was exclusive psalmody. And there are still Presbyterian churches that hold to that. And little by little, hymns were being allowed into the church. And so in this, this article by Barry Waugh starts with his he gives a background to before he actually just lets us read and presents the committee's own minutes and actions there. And this is a prelude. He says as we noted, the contemporary Christian church music, which provided transcription of an article by Peck and Robinson, Worship of the Lord in Song, has been controversial subject, particularly since the gradual transition from exclusive psalmody in the 18th century to inclusion of hymns by composers such as Isaac Watts was taking place. The words of Ephesians, Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs have often been turned differently, even by members within Presbyterianism, since the focus here is on that. The transcription that follows, which is the account itself that follows after this lengthy introduction by Barry, the transcription that follows is from the minutes of the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, old school, which means that it was the conservative, to use that maybe term today, or confessionalist group, old school General Assembly of 1849. And it addressed this controversy. A committee had been appointed to make recommendations regarding church music, and it appears, though I'm not certain, there were no ruling elders that were seated. The committee on church music had been appointed in the previous year by the moderator, and then a list of individuals are given here. What specifically was the committee addressing with regard to music? In 1843, the Old School Presbyterian Board of Publications issued Psalms and Hymns Adapted to Social, Private, and Public Worship in the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, a nice big title, which was printed in Philadelphia. It included the complete Psalter of Isaac Watts, followed by 680 hymns. In modern hymnal, the music is provided with words, but in earlier hymnals, and this would be true of this new edition that was done in the middle 1840s, the hymns were produced just with the words only, and then the music would be chosen and the people would be familiar because it would be familiar either metrical tunes or a well-known music. Each hymn is headed with a few words describing its topic and a notation regarding the meter to which the song, the hymn is sung. The hymns are not titled. This This seems unusual today, given hymns have the words and music for each one and a title. But in the 1843 hymnal shows a transition from psalm singing alone to psalms and hymns. Psalms for singing simply had the number of psalms, the meter, and then the words. The brief preface to the 798-page collection expressed the hope that, this is the quote, the collection itself comprehends that there that were supposed or assumed to be the best hymns in the ones now in use, with a large addition from other sources and in sufficient variety, it is presumed, to meet all the wants of worshipers. So he goes, Barry Wong goes on with a little bit more history that just opens up how the church was wrestling with its worship even then. I think every generation does, and the nature of it. So I think it's something you find very interested, and I can see why it was number three.
Yeah, I mean, this is this going along, Dominic, in your opinion, with the, you know, the idea of having a directory of worship, and that is binding in the PCA? I know that's that idea has been talked about.
Yes, I think it fits into that. I think at this point, the directory of worship, that as I recall, was already part of the constitution of the Presbyterian Church USA at that time, at the old school, if I recall.
Interesting. You know, the debate continues. So yeah, this is a, it is a very interesting article, kind of adds a little context to what I've been, you know, kind of seeing on the interwebs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number four, damned be dies to bind. This is by Timon Klein. Oregon wants to destroy the family literally. That's a subtitle. And so this arises out of some recent issues or matters that are being either talked about or have already been done in Oregon. And he talks about the family, what the nature of it is. So there's a lot of definitions of reference not only to how the church has dealt with it, but also courts have answered the matter. And so he, in the middle of this, he says, take a new case now, because he listed a number of judicial cases out of Oregon. Jessica Bates, a mother of five and young widow, felt called to foster and potentially adopt another child after the death of her husband. She is an evangelical Christian who was convicted by the biblical command to care for orphans while listening to a Christian radio broadcast. Predictably, and because of her biblical beliefs, Bates refused to agree as a condition of fostering in the state to, quote, respect, accept, and support the sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. In the statute outlining adoption home standards, respect, accept, and support means, as the statute makes clear, the use of a child's preferred pronouns, taking a child to pride or affirming events, and providing so-called gender-affirming pharmaceutical care like puberty blockers or hormone shots. The mandatory training Bates attended as part of the application process offered myriads of explanatory examples of how foster or adoptive parents should support and validate a child's self-expression, such as displaying symbols indicating an LGBTQ-affirming environment, attendance to events, including religious ones, openly hostile to the child's alleged gender and sexual identity and expression are not allowed. All of this and more is embedded in the foster care / adoption agreement for Oregon applicants. The message is clear. Christians, that is, dissenters and blasphemers of the establishment religion, need not apply. So Bates sued the Oregon Department of Human Services, which oversees the child care program for religious discrimination. The case is now an appeal in the Ninth Circuit after the lower court ruled against her. And so senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, Jonathan Scruggs, who is representing Bates, got it right. Oregon's policy amount to an ideological Litmus test, people who hold secular progressive views on sexual orientation and gender identity are eligible to participate in child welfare programs, while people of faith who with religiously informed views are disqualified because they don't agree with the state's orthodoxy. And this is exactly what we're up against. A more move over negative world. Welcome to the hostile world. And so this article is just highlighting this for us. It's still in the courts in terms of that Oregon case. So just be alert that with the culture defining, the definition of family, the relationship with parents to children, who's in charge, what you can say and can't say is before us. So this is one of those things we can say is a present tense part of the transformation that's taking place culture, which is also adversely impacting the church.
Yeah, this part of it I found interesting, and maybe it's something, that can actually give us a little common ground here. When he says move over negative world, welcome to hostile world. The foundation of relationship was not birth, it was worship. To quote Fustel again, inculcating religion is the mark and duty of parenting by all accounts, classical, biblical, and legal. It's not the state's religion, but the religion of the home, the hearth, the dinner table. He says even the very spooky Christian nationalists do not aspire to violate this right. To deny this prerogative is to deny parenthood, child rearing altogether. So, I know we've talked about this many times, Dominic, but to me it just seems, I think there are some, and it's varying degrees, but I think the Christians who are listening to the left or the pagans or whatever tell us who they really are. There are Christians that I think are believing them, obviously. And they've come to the conclusion, like I have, that if we just roll over, and yes, I know Christ is sovereign over all of this, and that's true. If we just keep going down this path, it just seems to me that they're going to put Christians in boxcars and camps. That's where this is headed if things don't change. And I think things are already changing at the local level. There are already means to do this. Obviously, this is in Oregon, which has views that are just totally, wild, I think, compared to more, places that have more, Christian churches and evangelicals. But I feel like that's really the divide right now. I think among Christians is, we're all kind of trying to convince each other what time it is. You know what I mean? And that seems to be where the debate is. And then that term Christian nationalism gets thrown in there and everybody has an opinion about it. So anyway,
That's right. And so how do we help along? Well, here comes Philip Ryan, and he has an article entitled, Where Are the Peaceable Presbyters? So maybe the way we go about it is, first of all, be peaceable in our presentation of our user. He says a recent dust up on Twitter has me asking, where are the peaceable presbyters? That presbyter being elders or ministers. Several years ago, I had a personal Twitter account, he says. It seemed like every PCA pastor was using it, and I felt like I was missing out on important debates and issues. I deleted my account after a fellow elder confronted me about something I posted. I appreciated the brother's courage to call me out, and we still disagreed about the substance of what I posted. But as I looked at it again, I saw how my tone was not inviting dialogue or seeking to persuade. Twitter was full of hot takes and quick-thumbed retorts, and I consciously or unconsciously was replicating what I saw. It was not a space promoting dialogue. Instead, feelings engaged with issues facing my denomination. I grew increasingly self-righteous and assumed many motives behind what others were posting. And a few years later, I created a new Twitter account because I kept receiving links to tweets and so forth. So he said things about the concept of peaceable. He says, Paul's telling Timothy, the character traits of elders is that it'd be peaceable. He says peaceable in the New American Standard version is translated as not quarrelsome in the ESV, as not quarrelsome in the ESV. So peaceable, not quarrelsome. Philip Towner, in his contemporary commentary on the pastoral epistle, writes, this tendency betrays an inability to get along with and accept the views of others and perhaps deeper personal flaws as well. This inability to get along must have been a problem with the early church, and so Paul addressed it. So he says, brothers, are we being peaceable presbyters? If our church members read our tweets, would they recognize us? Would they be shocked at the derision that we lob at one another? Would they see Christ glorified in our hasty judgments and other motives? And so the ridicule and scorn that we have seem to revel in. Let's be honest, if we're tweeting to win a brother or to slam him. So the call here that Philip Ryan has given is, what I like to summarize, contend without being contentious. And so it's a good reminder to remember that this is an important character issue for all of us, Paul, as we are dealing with some really tough and hot issues.
Yeah, you know, social media can easily just make people keyboard monsters. I mean, I'm certainly guilty of that as well. So, yeah, it is a good reminder. And I honestly don't know of it's really more of an organizing tool at this point. I don't know of anybody who actually is that actively posts back and forth that is ever convinced. Like, you know, when you try to engage somebody, it's just very rare that a Facebook comment or a tweet is actually going to change the other person's mind. Now, where it is valuable, and where you do see the censorship and the control that governments and Silicon Valley have tried to put on it, is most people are passive. Most people do not post. They have accounts and they just read the back and forth themselves. And it's there where people can be convinced, quite frankly. As the person that's not actually engaging is the person that is just there observing. And most people on the internet, they don't actually make comments. They just watch or observe from afar. Right.
The stalkers. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're just hanging out. That's good. But it's a good reminder that Philip gives here that we need to be careful, whether it's on Twitter or any other kind of format, whether we're speaking orally or whether we're writing it, we need to be careful. Make your point, as Paul says in 2 Timothy 2, 24-26, the Lord's servant is not quarrelsome, but is the one who speaks clearly so that you can bring someone to a conviction of their sin if necessary. All right, then next article, it is by Carl Truman, Lessons from the Lutheran Tradition. In 2024, he says, this last week, I had the privilege of speaking at a seminar for the Colloquium Fellows of Doxology, a group of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastors committed to spiritual care and counsel. And so he says at the end of this presentation, it was a Q&A time, and he was asked towards the end if what I thought confessional Lutheranism, he says, could offer to the church. And so he just quickly came up with these things, and then he teased them out a little bit more in this article. What can confessional Lutheranism teach? It can teach in general when faithful to its defining documents, focuses the mind of believers upon the great truths of Christian faith that take no account of the vicissitudes, that is, the issues of the age. God, Trinity, fall, incarnation, redemption, and grace. These are truths that feed the mind and the soul, regardless of which side wins and which side loses elections, talking about that in the political sense. And they are central concerns of the great confessional documents of Protestantism. So a faithful defining of the documents and holding to them. He says, a second principle or that I see in confessional Lutheranism has two particular important contributions to the church, Catholic today, Catholic with a small c, universal. First, the Lutheran distinction, echoing Augustine between the heavenly kingdom and the earthly kingdom. This distinction is vital, especially in the time of deep political divisions that affect the church and political issues surrounding us. And also as we're defining things like Christian nationalism and the like. And the Lutheran tradition also, properly understood, offers a way of understanding both the importance and the role of civil magistrate, but has limited significance for things that really matter to those things that pertain to eternity. So finally, he says that confessional Lutheranism can offer today's church a powerful understanding of the suffering of the church. Luther famously argued that the true theologian should be a theologian of the cross, placing the incarnation at the center of revelation. God reveals himself under opposites. His glory is hidden in flesh, his power in the weakness of the cross, his triumph over death in the apparent triumph of death over Christ. The theologian, too, should expect this as part of his life. The faithful Christian finds his strength in weakness. So he teases that out some more. And so he says, here's where confessional Lutheranism, in its terms of its own history, can speak to other evangelicals and to the broader church as well. I really appreciated that oversight that Carl Truman gave to us here.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't get my mic unmuted. Yeah, as always, you know, Carl Truman has a unique perspective and, you know, and a way to speak into the controversies and the issues of today. So.
Mm-hmm. And it shows that we can appreciate the, you know, the confessional stands of others that are within the broader Reformation history of the church as well, since there are internal distinctions in terms of structure, polity, and so forth between confessional Presbyterians and confessional Lutherans. There are a lot of things that we do hold in common. And then, so that brings us then how not to be a grumpy old man or woman, and I should say, or young man or young woman. Yeah, you don't have to be old to be grumpy. You can, attitude sort of spans, it's ageless, doesn't tie one side to the other. And he says, I suppose it's too late if you're still wondering about New Year's resolution, and this is by Bill Muhlenberg, as much as possible. You know, what your New Year's resolution should make. He said, well, as my title indicates, seeking to minimize as much as possible that many people turn into, over time, a grumpy old man or woman, and to be a goer. Of course, some, sadly, folks do not turn into this over time. It seems like it's become, they just are grumpy. But old age can seem to increase this disposition. So what... Bill Muhlenberg is, you know, just encouraging us to do is to not to look at everything with a gruff and a huff. He says, I know our life should be a witness to all, but it is not an either or, it's a both and. We must share the gospel with words, but our lives should back up and reflect what we're saying. As Paul says in Romans 10, 14 and 15, how then shall they call on him whom they have not believed, and how they to believe in him whom they have not heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. So when we, when I put up a post, say on social media, even a very short post, I try very hard to make sure it clearly says what I intended to say, so it will not be result unnecessarily to be misunderstood. And yet I'm still amazed that that will happen. He says, worse yet, they come and attack, you know, when they miss the point, they attack what they thought I said instead of what I actually said. This happens too often. So it's not a beautiful thing for it to take place. So Muhlenberger reminds us of that, quotes a couple of proverbs that when words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. It's a good one for us to remember. So in this article, just calling us again, it goes along, I think, Paul, with the not, you know, being peaceable not contending in a contentious way and so forth, just to learn how to address, you know, be confident in what is true and then, you know, speak it and be eloquent about it. But you don't have to become a grumpy old man or young man or young woman.
It kind of I really think it goes back to just, you know, this whole constant communication, social media, even email is so new. I mean, it's such an experiment. And versus, you know, in the olden days, okay, yeah, you had the newspaper, but there was more just face-to-face communication. And when you talk to somebody face-to-face, you know, you get all of these other context clues, and it's difficult to ascribe the worst motives when you are, you know, talking somebody face-to-face. And you certainly, even if you do disagree, you certainly don't treat them the way we treat each other on social media. Again, I'm you know, I'm guilty of it for sure. So it's this new experiment that we still are, you know, figuring out how to use. And a lot of it, quite frankly, you could say is really just unproductive, generally. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And, well, we move on to a review, that's quite an interesting title, and I'm frankly surprised, you know, this is article number 8 that was on the top 10. It's a review, and it has the interesting title of the book is Omphalos, right? An attempt to untie the geological knot. Did God create the earth with functional maturity is the general theme of the book. And it's a book review by Sean McGinty. He says in 1857, Philip Goss, a respected naturalist, released a book that's titled Omphalos, an attempt to untie the geological knot. The book was an apologetic exercise in harmonizing the position that creation occurred several thousand years ago, so that's young Earth theory, along with the presence of geological structures that seemingly suggested a longer time frame. Although the book is quite long, the central premise is very easy to describe. Goss's observation led him to believe that the mature forms of all natural objects are dependent upon immature forms for their structures. He concluded that an instantaneous creation must come into existence with a type of backstory, and that is, an Earth only a few minutes old would possess things like multiple geological layers and fossils and such. Now, he says that when someone like Stephen Gould evaluated this book or gave a review, he called it that God was the great deceiver. Then he wasn't doing, you know, he wasn't being honest with what we saw. In other words, what you see is what you get. So here's the real reason that Gould dislikes Goss, McGinty says in his review. He feels the foundations of his knowledge, that is, that Gould feels like if I'm really studying geology as I see it presented, that's my foundation of the knowledge. So if he feels the foundation of his knowledge starting to shake, if Goss is right, then we are revealed to not be in control of our world. Our methods are exposed as hollow. And if we are not firmly in the wheel, then everything must be a joke. But what a wonderful joke it is. The Lord has used the weak things of the world to shame the wise. All of our best attempts pale in the light of his glory and wisdom. Like Job, we must say, therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. So he says, Gould finishes his review with a picture of Goss as a broken man rejected by the worldly wise. And he spends his evenings in gloom. And this is what Gould assumed it to be the case. That wasn't the case at all. Goss stands to toast the one who plans and forms the inscrutable beauty. Gould stands as well. And from him comes an admission that reveals that which reveals which of the men is the true traitor. So mature functionality and versus is everything the way just what we can observe of how did God choose to create this world, a magnificent world that we're living in. So very brief review, but I think it stirred some ideas in me that I had really considered, Paul.
Well, yeah, I think there's been a controversy online just to dealing with, if God made Adam and Eve as mature adults, then, he could have made the earth as well, seemingly have some sort of, maturity to it. Right. And mm-hmm. So that's got people, back and forth talking about it. So I think this article is kind of another take on it. The temptation, the way I see it, is that there's so much temptation to try to want to take modern science and, just take that as gospel. And there's this kind of knee-jerk reaction of we want to be legitimate in public life. So we've got to figure out a way to make the biblical account, jive with what we're observing now. And I don't know, I think science is proven wrong a lot as time goes by. I mean, I was raised to believe that oil came from, dinosaurs and plants that had been buried for millions and millions of years, and now there's actual credible evidence that that's not where oil comes from. At least there's, scientists looking into that, and some people even think it's a renewable resource. So, that's kind of where I fall on all of this.
A friend, older friend of mine who just not in the last year or so has gone home to glory, used to sign his letters instead of sincerely or so forth. He would sign in the name of the one who changed water into wine. And he believed in the young earth. And so he said the thrust there is when you ponder that from John 2, when Jesus changed, the wedding at feast at Canaan, that when they were running out of wine, that they filled up urns, jugs with water, and then he was told steward was told to taste the wine and distribute it. He said it was the best wine he'd ever taken. Well, the water had just changed to wine; it hadn't been there, so it didn't go through the long process of maturation and where we get stronger and right, whatever way, the process it goes through to become the wine that we drink. And so that was the point. The one who changed the water to wine was instantaneous, and it tasted better than anything they had had before. And nobody thought that it was less, how old it was. They just knew it to be really good. So that's an interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that was Christ doing a lot of things. But one of the things, I saw somebody post this, that was Christ showing that he is he's the Lord of time. I mean, he controls time itself,
right.
Which I thought was fascinating. There's also, Dominic, a Johnny Cash song called He Turned the Water into Wine, and it's one of my favorites. So.
Oh, I'll have to listen. I don't think I've heard that one. Okay, well, number nine on the list is The Ruling Elder and the Ministry of Prayer. One Ruling Elder's Experience with Prayer is by Steve Dowling, who is a ruling elder in the Covenant Presbyterian Church in Opelika, Alabama, just outside of Auburn. And he mentions, I was almost 30 and had been in the Marine Corps for about a decade when God abruptly entered my life in a Damascus Road type of experience. The spiritual change was immediate, but my ignorance of spiritual things was entrenched. I knew nothing about God except that he was real, he was personal, and that I was his. These basic realizations made prayer the most natural thing in the world for me. Since the point of my conversion forward, I wanted to do everything in my life by reference to God, and so I needed to be constantly talking to him. And I was naive and overwhelmed, but I had not yet thought that I could pray wrongly. It was clear to me that God was God and I was not. Therefore, I had no problem with deferring to him, no real desire to get my own way, and no inclination to ask merely for the benefits package, and ask the health and wealth kind of thing. So he said over time, though, he learned that there is more to the prayer, and he says, below are some of the errors in prayer that I have witnessed or fallen into over the course of my Christian life. My hope is that this brief list highlights some things all of us, and especially as ruling elders, and so he's speaking to his fellow elders in the church, need to be careful about while trying to serve the church. And so he lists different things to avoid because we can fall into these kinds of errors. And he explains them all, so we don't want to go into them. But one of them is hypocrisy, you know, where Jesus warns, for instance, in Matthew 5, us not to pray like hypocrites. So when we're praying, let's not act that way, and gives a good explanation here. Vanity, God denounces that in Matthew 6, 7, where Christ cautions disciples against imitating the babbling of Gentiles and pagans. And they were doing it because it was vain pretense on their part. Or selfishness, where you ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly and you spend it on your passions. Let's avoid that. And then not listening. The fourth error, he says, is not listening, where Psalm 119 says, your word is a lamp on my feet and a light to my pathway. It is become obvious to me now that the unbridled communication I enjoyed when I was first saved was pretty much on unidirectional. I talked and talked and saw the hand of God everywhere, but it took me over a year for me to begin to listen well and see that the word of God was giving me detailed answers to many of my prayers. And so listening, because that light that God gives that's on the pathway. So given more space, he says, I could share more observations about lack of persistence in prayer, the effects of distraction, and so on, but I will close with this personal reflection. When I was first saved, I loved talking to God and seeing him at work. I still do. Yet now I now see that there's a lot to be gained from a little structure, like actually having a regular quiet time where I pray and where I pray the Bible. I am sure that intentionally waiting upon him does not interfere with him hearing me, and it certainly does not stop me from seeing him constantly at work. So just a wonderful exhortation from a fellow elder to us in the whole process of prayer in the believer's life.
And he says, but it absolutely helps me hear him better. It makes me more aware of what I am doing when I am trying to serve the church. And then he references 1 Timothy 2:1-2. First of all, then I urge that supplications, prayers, and intercessions and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way.
Absolutely. All right. Number 10, destroying marriage in order to save it. And it's by Daniel Frost and Robert P. George. He says, they say a recent article in the New Yorker paints a rosy picture of the many ways that polyamory and non-monogamy are making inroads into the American culture. Amid a great deal of wishful thinking, one claim stands out, that opening your marriage to additional sexual partners can make it stronger. The New Yorker article notes that non-monogamy is increasingly being presented not as a threat to bourgeois marriage, but rather as a way to save the institution and all that it affords. So that's the idea of the title. You have to destroy your concept of marriage in order to really save what marriage is, as these authors are, of course, going to take a different position.
I believe he says, George W. Bush said in 2008 that he had to violate free market principles to save the free market.
That's right. I remember him saying that. You're right. And sometimes we don't get it. Well, and what we put in its place is not it doesn't really replace the substance of it in any regard, which is the point of this article. They go, this claim about you've got to destroy it in order to make it or to save it would be laughable if it weren't taken so seriously. It's a bit like the infamous and apocryphal claim from an American military officer in the Vietnam War, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. Marital infidelity strikes at the heart of marriage, at its total commitment expressed in vows of permanence and exclusivity. Spouses who engage in sexual non-monogamy, even if they act with each other's consent, undermines the basis of an authentic and honorable marriage. And when their actions are public, and especially where they are publicly affirmed and celebrated, They further wound the culture of marriage that everyone benefits from when it is secured and flourishing. And he says you can go through these friendship concepts they talk about. An ordinary friendship has certain structure and point. In a true friendship, each friend wills the good of the other for the sake of the other. Without this goodwill, there is no friendship. As it weakens, a friendship withers. Now imagine one friend upset that the other is perceived wrong. Speaks maliciously of his friends behind his back, impugning his character. We would all have to admit that this action was a betrayal of the friendship. Well, now imagine that slander's goal was to blow off steam over the perceived wrong and then return to the friendship with less resentment. Of course, they'll say it's not going to happen. Now you can compare this to marriage. Like friendship, marriage has a structure and point. The structure is not subject to endless revision and modifications, but it's a function of basic aspect of human well-being and fulfillment. As Western law and culture historically recognize, marriage is a two-in-one flesh conjugal union of husband and wife. As a distinctive human good, marriage is an all-encompassing union. It unites man and woman at every level of their person's heart, mind, and body. For the body is a part of the person, not just a tool. In this vision, sexual intercourse is not just a way of feeling closer to someone different than someone different only in degree from the gestures and affections. It alone can seal a marriage with a comprehensive bond by extending a total union of heart and mind, including total commitment into the bodily dimension. So all of the modern attempts to redefine marriage is not saving it. It's only wounding it, and it's really persons seeking after their own self-pleasure to maybe also rejecting, centuries and centuries of norms. We see that anytime something new comes along, it's more a rebellion, an act of rebellion against God and his structure, which he ordained from creation till the present time. So a very helpful article here on by Frost and George, Destroying Marriage in Order to Save It. Ain't going to work.
Yeah, it's incredible. And then we have all these, people now that also, they're wanting to be this promiscuous, but they don't want to have kids. And I was just making the observation. It's funny how God kind of even puts in almost like a civilization destruct, like a natural mechanism. It's like, you start with, speaking of the slippery slope, Dom, you start with, women burning their bras in the 60s to Woodstock, which increased the amount of, sexual promiscuity outside of marriage. But then that leads to the illicit distribution of pornography, which is available to any kid who's got a cell phone, which is actually resulting in the plummeting of our birth rates and fertility in this country. And so in a way, our wicked civilization is, basically set to collapse because we're producing less people. I don't know, just an observation. Mm-hmm. I will say he nails it at the very end of this when he says, infidelity being a solution to marital difficulties is the same way that euthanasia is a solution for illness. And that kind of sums it up.
Right. Very good. Okay, well, that, Paul, brings us to the end of the top 10 list on the Akula Report in Weekly Review for Monday, January 22, 2024. And tomorrow, on the 23rd, you'll receive your newsletter on the mail. When you get it in the email, feel free to forward it to family and friends, others in your small group, your Sunday school group, and share with others that they can discuss things with you, and hopefully it might be good discussion starters and things that prompt us to be more faithful in our walk with Christ. And so we look forward to sharing this again next week when we meet together. So for Paul Harrell and Dominic Quill, we thank you for being with us, and trust the Lord will continue to watch over you as you walk before him.